Hebrew Bible, a passage from the prophet Isaiah, who speaks of a time when perhaps peace might enter into the lives of the people of Israel. So Isaiah speaks for God when he says, "For I am about to create new heavens and a new earth. The former things shall not be remembered or come to mind, but be glad and rejoice forever in what I am creating, for I am about to create Jerusalem as a joy and its people as a delight. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and delight in my people. No more shall the sound of weeping be heard in it or the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant that lives but a few days or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. For one who dies at 100 years will be considered a youth, and one who falls short of 100 will be considered accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be offspring blessed by the Lord, and their descendants as well. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, but the serpent, its food shall be dust. They shall not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, says the Lord." This is our word from Holy Scripture this morning. Thanks be to God. Today we have invited two guests from the Legion to come and speak to us. Lieutenant Colonel Bob McLeod and Flight Lieutenant, is it? Okay. Malcolm Hughes, who served with the RAF. Bob is currently the president of the local Legion, Legion 291, which just started a couple of years ago. But Malcolm was instrumental in getting that started. You've been here for some 40 years in serving with the Legion, is that correct, Malcolm? Yeah. Something like that. They have been asked to come and speak about their experience and tell us a little bit about what is going on today, and we are delighted to have not only have them, but to thank them for their service. Come on up.
Thank you, Julia, and thank you all. It's a great privilege to be here and join with you this Sunday morning of Remembrance Day weekend. Of course, back in UK, where obviously I'm from, there's perhaps still a trace of the accent left. But the Remembrance Day service takes place on the Sunday nearest to November 11th in UK, and has done for quite some time now. It was not always like that. As I grew up during and just after the war, at 11 o'clock on the 11th of November, everything stopped. Trains stopped, buses stopped, everybody got off, and we stood there, whatever we were doing, we stood in silence for 2 minutes, and then everyone climbed on, and that was signaled by the use of the old air raid sirens that gave us such a scare night after night during the bombings that we sustained. The nights that I spent in a hole dug in the ground, 6 feet by 6 feet, covered with 3 pieces of tin, and then the soil from the hole was thrown over the top. That was our bomb shelter. It was called an Anderson shelter. I'm not sure who Anderson was, but it wasn't the best design, I don't think, for sustaining a 500-pound bomb. However, we survived, unlike some of my young friends in school who sadly did not. But I'm here to talk a little bit more about Canadians and the Canadian way. I learned a great deal about this as a young boy. We were surrounded in where I'm from, in starting about late 42 through to the end of the war, by the members of 6th Group Bomber Command. All of those stations that that the Canadians flew from. And we watched those Halifaxes and Lancasters take off night after night, and knowing that when they came back, there'd be far fewer, and that those that did come back would probably be badly damaged. And we did watch them come back on a single engine of four, with holes you could see from 5,000 feet through the fuselages and so on. And those Canadians continued to do that for the rest, basically the rest of the war. But they weren't the first. Although some of them flew with the RAF in early parts of the war before 6th Group was formed. The first ones, of course, were those 60 men, young men, who came over and flew in the Battle of Britain. 16 of those fellows were killed, and they made great contributions as part of what was called at that time the Big Wing. Out of southeast England, where I ultimately was stationed when I was in the RAF. Those men were part of probably one of the most incredible battles that ever took place in the air. And of course, it's the battle that drew the words from Winston Churchill, never in the field of human conflict has so much been owed by so many to so few. Those 60-odd Canadians were part of the few. In addition, of course, we had that situation where the whole of the British Expeditionary Force was over in France. After the declaration of war on September 1 of 1939, basically, the Brit army that was active at the time was pretty well all shipped over to help stem that that advance through the Netherlands in through northern France and Belgium. And of course, ultimately, that did not succeed. And we had Dunkirk. By that time, we had the Canadians in England. They were there very, very quickly after Canada declared war independently, as you know, for the first time. Canada declared war on September 10th. About 8 years before that, 1931, with the signing of the British North, or the British North America Act, gave Canada its independence. And the Prime Minister at the time, rather than doing what happened in World War I, when Britain declared war, Canada was in it automatically. In the Second World War, they took a week to assert their independence, rightly so, I think, and declared war. Canada declared war on the 10th of September. Very quickly after that, we had a division of Canadian soldiers in England. Not too well trained, they hadn't had time to be trained. Nevertheless, they were a fighting group. And after Dunkirk, clearly what was left of the British Army, the British Expeditionary Force, was in no position to defend the country. They came home shell-shocked and in absolutely terrible shape. And had Hitler succeeded through the Battle of Britain to gaining air superiority, then there would have been an invasion. And really the only men who were ready to face such an invasion were the Canadians. They saved England. I have no doubt in my mind that the reason I'm here and alive is because of the Canadians. They helped keep us alive after 6th Group was formed. There may be others in this congregation who remember this, the hardships, the lack of food, because the food went to the military. We survived because the government of the day provided us with one meal at school and a little bottle of milk. Each child received that 5 days a week. My mother cooked school meals, which leads to me cooking Legion meals these days, but that's okay. But that really wasn't sufficient. The 4 ounces of meat we had was Sunday's meat, 4 ounces a week per person. But the Canadians brought us things that we just didn't get. From their own rations, they would come into town, and if they saw a kid like myself, they would give us something. And that's what really kept us going. As an aside, you may remember, of course, that the first Canadians into conflict were the guys who were shipped over to defend Hong Kong. And Christmas, of course, that Christmas day when Hong Kong fell and the Canadians were taken prisoner. My wife's best friend and her family were imprisoned by the Japanese following the fall of Hong Kong. And 60 years later, at a reunion, my wife's best friend was over there, and she sent us a photograph of herself laying flowers on Canadian graves, not British graves, her best friend is still in England, laying flowers on Canadian graves because the Canadians had kept those kids alive. British Red Cross parcels were not allowed in for some reason, were not allowed into Hong Kong, but they allowed the Canadian ones in, and the Canadians shared them with the Brits. And she always, she's never been to Canada. We've tried to get her here, but she never has been. But she still reveres Canadians for what they did. And so it wasn't just those large, all-encompassing efforts of Canadians. It was the small gestures, the little things that they did that kept us going and kept us alive. And so the importance of Canadians to the war effort in Britain were, I think, incalculable. I don't think we've seen enough written about it. However, they were there. They did more than we could have asked of them, and they kept Britain going when Britain did not have the resources to keep going, either in the air or by land, and ultimately by sea, because the growth of the Canadian Navy is one of the major reasons that those convoys got through that brought the stuff that we needed to survive. Again, a relatively unknown effort that we hear very little about. In all three elements, air, land, and sea, Canadians, in my opinion, were a good part of the people who saved England during those dark days of 1939, 1940, 1941. And I don't know this, but I think that it was because I got to know so many of them that I ultimately came to this country 50 years ago this year. My wife and I have celebrated that every day since August the 9th, the day that we landed in Montreal off the boat and made our way across country by train and saw what this country was all about. It was amazing. However, just one or two of the slides, and then we'll turn it over to Bob, who has many other things to talk about. The first slide shows, of course, a man that probably the face is known to most people, Montgomery, talking to Canadian troops. Initially, can you hear me without this? Okay, thank you for that. Is that better? No?
There you go.
Is that good, Mike?
Yeah, good. Sorry about that. I was a high school principal, and I was used to speaking to large crowds of kids, and I thought my voice was still good enough for that. Obviously not. Here's Monty talking to Canadians from his Brent carrier. This is obviously early part of the Italian. I originally thought it was the Eighth Army in the desert, but I now believe that this, given some of the background, is actually when the Canadians joined the Eighth Army for the invasion of Sicily in Italy. Of course, Monty was quite the showman and quite the motivator, but he was always out there among the troops talking to them and cajoling them. But the one thing that Canadians and most people remember about Monty is how careful he was. Some of the American generals, as you know, criticized him heavily because he was rather slow to take some of his objectives. But Monty's point always was, it's important to not just go in and quite happily have 1,000 men killed when you can go in and do the job over a longer period and only perhaps lose 100. It's a slightly different approach that some of the American generals took, of course. And he was heavily criticized for it. Our next slide shows a tanker crew relaxing, and I believe Bob would know this better than I, but I think that's a Sherman. Right, that's a Sherman tank. Bob was in that area in the military, in that section, so he would recognize that before I would. A tanker crew, a Sherman crew, typically four, a junior NCO, probably a corporal, perhaps a sergeant, and three privates in the tank, and they would go.
The missing one because in the Sherman they had a co-driver,
the machine gun, and that left her, okay. Oh, there we go, he's probably on guard somewhere. Sherman, of course, was the tank that the Brits and the Canadians used, and of course was heavily outgunned by the Tiger tanks. And these fellows going in those tanks up against those Tigers were at a great, great disadvantage, both in firepower, speed, size, and armory, and everything else. And they did a marvelous job. Okay, next slide. Here we have Canadians and on parade with, again, what we see is either a French or an Italian officer. We're pretty sure it's an Italian officer. This would have been sometime either in Sicily or Italy after the Italians had surrendered. And, of course, that brought masses of several panzer divisions and so on out of Russia and from Northern Europe, and the Canadians then found themselves up against, really for the first time, the might of the German army. Up to this point in time, they'd been fighting the Italians, and again, if you've seen any of the footage of the Canadian contribution to the Italian campaign, you'll know that they were, as usual, given some of the toughest assignments. They took the most heavily defended areas, and they succeeded. Quite frequently, they were sent in after some other group had failed to take the target, because they were considered the shock troops, who did things, by the way, in a quite unorthodox manner. There was one particular campaign in Sicily where they were instructed by the British High Command to go and take a particular objective. And the Canadian officers said, "Well, that's stupid. We'll do it our way." And you may have seen films on the Devil's Brigade. Well, a group of Canadians were called the Red Devils. And they did something very similar to what you may have seen in the film from the Devil's Brigade. Instead of going up on a frontal, they went and climbed a hill in the middle of the night, went up the backside of a hill, and they all made it up to the top and surprised the Germans from the backside at 4 o'clock in the morning and took that objective. Nobody thought anyone would ever be daft enough to go and try and climb up that particular hill. If you watch the History Channel, there was a reenactment of that done, I think it was a year ago. And the young fellows who climbed up weren't carrying packs and rifles or anything else, and they struggled to get to the top in daylight. That Canadian battalion got up there in the middle of the night. An amazing, amazing a piece of military tactics. The next slide is one, of course, that we see a good deal of. This is removing the wounded from the beach to take them back to UK, back to the hospitals. I had a friend, an Air Force pilot, who was shot down on D-Day and parachuted into the channel. And he was picked up. He had no idea, of course, it was D-Day when he took off. He was just flying one of his regular sorties. But he was picked up by one of the boats going in. And luckily, and he was sort of dumped onto the beach. It happened to be the Canadian beach, where he was kept for about 3 days because there was no room on the boats going back to England. The boats going back to England were for the wounded. He finally was taken by the Canadians and on a boat back, which was torpedoed, and he was finding himself back in the water again, and picked up again. And finally back to England, where his Welsh accent was a little bit much for some of the people who received him, and they thought he was a German spy. So they put him in jail. The Canadians were sort of, you know, they were pretty sure they knew he wasn't. But anyway, his CO came down from West Malling station and identified him, put him in a clean uniform, and sent him back to Wales, where he arrived in typical Welsh weather, raining, middle of the night, knocked on the door, and his wife came to the door and said, "Clear off, you're dead." She really thought he was a ghost. She'd been told he was, you know, he'd been killed. I told that story at his funeral, and his son had never heard it. His son had never heard that story. Just like most of the sons of those who fought never hear the stories. But again, Canadians did their part in that little episode that we'll never forget. Again, removing the wounded and putting them on the small personnel, small landing craft. The next one shows the legless ace, Dougie Bader. That's Dougie Bader in the coveralls in the middle. You may have heard of him, the legless fighter ace, shot down over France. And he was respected so much by the German Luftwaffe, they allowed an airplane to fly over and drop him another artificial leg because he lost it in the, you know, in struggling to get out of the cockpit. His artificial leg was stuck. And so he jumped out and left the artificial leg behind. he rewarded them the next night by escaping from the prisoner of war camp. And so every night after that, the Germans took his artificial leg off so he couldn't get out. Dougie Bader was a great character. But he's surrounded there by a group of Canadian pilots. Those are all Canadians. And the plane is a Hurricane. You can tell that from the cockpit. It's a different kind of a cockpit from a Spitfire. And that's the only clue we've got, that's a Hurricane down there. Okay, again, part of the Battle of Britain group. And my last before Bob takes over is a couple of Canadian pilots hanging onto the prop. Again, this is obviously a Spit. My last little thing about Canadians is when I moved back to Alberta, I retired originally out to BC, came back 12 years ago, looking for a place to live, and I saw one home, I went back to see it. We wanted to purchase a home. Felt it was a little bit high price, and we were walking around with the owner on the second visit, not the realtor. And I noticed a picture on the wall, and I said, is this you, sir? And he said, yeah, that's me. And this was a fellow in pilot's uniform standing by his Spitfire. And I said, that looks like 142 Squadron. He said, yeah, it is. I said, that was my squadron as well. But he'd been Battle of Britain. I was somewhat later. And so I didn't buy the house because I would not insult him by making him a lower offer than he was asking for the house. I now live next door to it.
Thank you, Malcolm. I'm afraid I don't have the history in my mind that Malcolm does, so I'll perhaps use the slides a little bit more than Malcolm has. Now, the next series of slides features samples of pictures of D-Day landings on the beaches of Normandy and within France, on top with the pictures of the present day leisure and beaches and the quiet towns 70 years later in 2014. Now, the bloody battle and hardship and danger on the top seem a long way from the relaxing and safe beaches of today. And Malcolm pointed out to me in this picture earlier today that that's the Canadians. The Canadians were the first to capture German prisoners because when they landed at Juneau, they advanced further than any of the other allies. And they captured a number of Germans. And that house is kind of an iconic picture of that you'll see in many photos of D-Day. Now, on many of the beaches and beachheads, there remains little evidence of the terrible conflict or the suffering needed to achieve that freedom, the peace and prosperity. When you look at the two photographs, and you wonder what the soldiers who did not make it past the beaches would say if they could see what their battlefields and beaches look like today. These are dramatic changes paid for by the lives of Canadians and the Allied airmen and women and the soldiers and the sailors. Could you back up, Steve, please? Yeah.
That beach is the one that's featured in The Longest Day. This is the American at Omaha. And if you saw that film, President Roosevelt's son is the fellow who led them off this beach. And what you've got up at the top is the fellows facing incredible fire, taking what we call a Bangalore torpedo, that tube there. And the Bangalore torpedo was sort of screwed together, pushed up till they reached the barbed wire and the defenses, and then they blow it up from back here. In the meantime, most of those fellows who carried those torpedoes died, but they had no defense whatsoever. Very few of them survived those kind of tactics.
Yeah, and aside from the sort of wire that we see in movies, there were wire strands called low wire entanglement. And what they would do, there would be stakes about this high and barbed wire that would be running back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So you could see the rolls of wire in front of you, but in fact you had to run through a maze like a checkerboard of barbed wire, and you were very likely to fall down and then become a terrible target. Now, after conflicts like World Wars I and II, virtually all the countries involved had compassion and they understood the need to rebuild and promote peace, and evidenced by the Marshall Plan, or as it was called formally, the European Recovery Plan after World War II. And such as it evidenced here on the beach, you see the difference between 1944 and today. And there's little to remind us of the price that was paid to save the bunkers, memorials, and the graves of those who did not come home. But many of these wars were a long time before many of us were born. World War I, 56,000, and in fact, the World War II, more than 45,000 Canadians were killed, and a great number of them in the Air Force. 516 Canadians died in Korea. United Nations missions since Korea, more than 100 were killed. More than 100 have been killed. And of course, and we're all familiar with Afghanistan and the 158 Canadian soldiers who passed away. Many more of these folk came home and their lives were changed forever. Now, the Legion supports them directly with medically, financially, for those in great need, through lodging, through counseling, bursaries for their descendants, scholarships, food banks, and also helping them communicate and get benefits from the Veterans Affairs and through our representations to the Canadian government on their behalf. Now, the results of these recent sacrifices are not nearly as apparent in places like Afghanistan, Bosnia, Kosovo, Egypt, the Golan, Lebanon, Israel, Haiti, and Iraq, and a number of places where the Canadian forces have been deployed since Korea. But we need to measure the value of their contributions as increments in the journey towards peace and safety for those who have never experienced it at all in their lives. There's another connection too, that certainly from us in Alberta. ATCO hasn't been afraid to go to places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Kabul, and Kandahar in Afghanistan, Haiti, and many other places in support of the Canadian forces, the United Nations, and NATO. And I find that an awful lot of people don't realize where our ATCO has gone in support of all of these missions. I mention this because we often hear of our Canadian forces' efforts and lives might have been wasted because we don't see the dramatic improvements that we saw after World War I and World War II. I can say with confidence the Canadian forces have made a real difference. I've had the opportunity to serve with the Canadian forces in Egypt and Israel, and beside them in Kosovo, Afghanistan, Sudan, and Haiti. And through the modern day communications that we have now with email and LinkedIn and Facebook with former colleagues and workers and employees and friends in all these places, including Afghanistan, I can say their lives are better. You can see it in their pictures, from their words, and their pride in their families, and their outlook towards their jobs and their businesses and their future. Canada is respected for what its soldiers, sailors, and Air Force has done, but as we know, there was a price. And this is, of course, a picture of a ramp ceremony in Afghanistan in Kandahar. And I think you're certainly aware, we used to have a lot of rockets would come in, And so what would happen, there wasn't any formal announcement of a ramp ceremony. Whenever a soldier went home, there was a very large ceremony on the tarmac as the coffins were loaded into the Canadian aircraft. But there was no formal announcement. Word was passed around because any sort of a gathering like that on the apron would have been a target for the Taliban. And remembering those who gave their lives, so those without hope can have a chance to live with freedom and the prosperity we have here in Canada. And for those of us here, remembering those who came home with their lives changed forever. Thank you, Reverend, and thank you for allowing us to come today.